shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hands with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute, so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. If you meet your enemy's ox or the donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. You shall not pervert the judgment of your poor in his dispute. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous. For I will not justify the wicked, and you shall not, and you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds and discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. Also, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt.
Alright, a lot of really important principles about justice here, really. In verse 1, you can't bear false witness. You know, you can't give a false testimony or support a false witness. You know, give some kind of confirming testimony for a false witness. Witnesses are so important in judicial matters. And it's just vital that the witness, you know, be honest. And if he's not, you know, injustices, terrible things can be done. In verse 2, he says, you shall not follow the masses in doing evil. You can't join the crowd in perverting justice. You know, there's a lot of times there's a lot of social pressure. Everybody's saying something, and you don't want to be the only one to stand up and say, no, that's not true. You know, everybody's rushing to condemn, and you don't want to say, but there's no evidence here. You know, so you've got to be careful to have the courage and the sense of justice to be willing to stand even against the multitude for what is really just and right. That's an important thing. Following the crowd in any area does not necessarily lead to righteousness. And then in 4 and 5, well, oh, 3. I like that one. You would have expected the opposite. And he's got the opposite a good bit. But in this case, what's he saying?
You shouldn't be partial to the poor.
You would normally think you shouldn't be unjust to the poor. You know, more often than not, they took advantage of the poor. We saw that at the end of the last chapter. But sometimes people unfairly favor the poor. Well, this guy is just poor. You know, he needs... You see that sometimes in product liability suits and things like that. You know, some freak accident occurs in a car and the guy's suing some big car manufacturer for big money. You know, and the jury thinks, well, that poor guy, he doesn't have anything and this big, you know, company is rich and it won't ever bother. You know, we'll give him a judgment. No, no. You do what's right. You do what's just and fair. It is not right to pervert justice, even to favor the poor man. God is it for justice, for righteousness, doing the right thing. Roger.
What until they were both bodied with Jesus, right?
Yes.
Some false witnessing and that people just follow the crowd.
Sure.
You may think, oh, it's not a big deal to follow the crowd and do what's wrong. I mean, that got Jesus killed. And I think if we would have been there, we're like, oh, who's going to stand up? But this guy's innocent and... They just follow the crowd and Jesus died.
Good point. And then in 4 and 5, what about if your enemy's ox or donkey is wandering? But he's your enemy. Isn't that interesting? Or what if you see the donkey of somebody who hates you, who's, you know, burdened down with a load and lying down and the owner can't get him up? You help. You know, you treat your enemy right. You're helpful, and you reach out to doing whatever he needs you to do. Encouraging passage, in my judgment. And then in verse 6, you shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. Now here's the other side of the coin. He's really saying no favoritism for or against the poor. You do what's right and fair and just, whatever his economic circumstances are. no false charges. Don't kill the innocent or the righteous. I will not acquit the guilty. You know, be just. Be right. No bribes. Why no bribes? Yeah, I mean, bribery is a great way to cause injustice to be done. That'll certainly not be a good thing. And don't oppress a stranger, a foreigner. And again, why does he say that? Yes, you know what it's like. You went through that yourself. Don't oppress a foreigner. Comments and thoughts? Yes, John.
All the laws and regulations from 22, 21 on through here, 23, were summed up by Jesus so simply, whatever you want me to do, you do it to them. And that's true not only for the negative things we wouldn't go against and harm someone the way we wouldn't want, but it's very hard for us to think about that in a positive way. Being proactive and doing for others.
Good point. Yeah. It's easier just not to hurt the guy than to actively help. I agree. And God requires both. Dan.
I think, you know, if we were to reenact and actually follow verse 5, you know, in our life, if we were to help somebody else, we would kind of see that as, well, what's extra credit? I did a nice deed. It's something, you know, if I, you know, help a guy out of a ditch or, you know, help a little lady across the street, like, that's a good thing. Right? You know, but I definitely commend them. But for the Lord, he's demanding that we be courageous. He's demanding that we help people. It's not something that, well, you know, if you feel extra spiritual, you can do that. It's a demand.
Good point. Right.
I think one thing that the Israelites fell into was that maybe they looked at some of these laws, and because there were so many, they saw some of them as trivial. And I don't know, one cool thing, especially like the ones we get the foreigners and the widows and the orphans, but in Malachi chapter 3, verse 5, we see, so I will come to put you on trial. I'll be quick to testify against sorcerers, adulterers, and perjurers, against those who defraud laborers of their wages, who oppress the widows and the fatherless, and deprive the foreigners among you of justice. But do not fear me. I don't know, I think even we can get into the tendency that, you know, we just focus on the big stuff, and we tend to overlook those little spiritual issues or anything like that. But the people in Malachi were condemned for the things that they probably overlooked as little, just trivial, silly things. And we have to watch out for that for ourselves.
Okay, good point. John.
Why is he so clear about bribes here, but in the Proverbs there are some statements made that almost make bribes sound as if they're, you know, a good thing? For example, a bribe is a charm in the sight of its owner. Wherever he turns, he prospers.
Mm-hmm. I think some proverbs are observational proverbs. They just tell how things are. And sometimes bribes work. Doesn't mean they're right, but they work. And I think that's all those are saying. Yeah. Freedom.
I don't know. I was just thinking about how the Pharisees would come up with some of these doctrines, like, I just love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. And just with this, even a superficial reading of some of this stuff, you know, you wonder how they come up with some of that. How we view the law, you know, were they really serious about what the law said, or, you know, just trying to.
Well, we sometimes commit equally terrible sins with the word. People kind of read what they want to into the Bible. But certainly it wasn't what the scriptures taught. Other thoughts? Okay. 10 to 19. Special time.
You shall sow your land for 6 years and gather it into yield. But on the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave, the beasts of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days you are to do your work, but on the seventh day you shall cease from labor, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave as well as your stranger may refresh themselves. Now concerning everything which I have said to you, be on your guard, and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. 3 times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread as I commanded you, at the appointed time in the month of Iv. For in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. Also you shall observe the feast of the harvest, of the first fruits of your labors from what you sow in the field. Also the feast of the ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor is the fat of my feast remain overnight until morning. You shall bring the choice first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You are not to boil the young goat in the milk of its mother.
Okay. So, first of all, in 10 and 11, what does he speak about? Yes. What was this?
Put the same crop on land over and over again, the land.
That's true. What do we call this here?
Sabbath for the ground.
Yeah, this is like a Sabbath year. That every 7th year, they were to let the ground lie fallow. They were not to plant and reap. And they were not to reap the vineyards and the olives and so forth. There was 1 year out of every 7, they just let the land rest, so to speak. Now, do you suppose they followed that? You know, it appears that rather quickly they didn't. And in fact, one of the reasons that God gave for the captivity was to give the land its rest. In the end of 2 Chronicles 36:21, all the days of its desolation, maybe I should start in the beginning of 21, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, they kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. The implication of that is, if they weren't going to give the land the rest every 7th year, eventually God kicked them off of their land and gave the land their overdue Sabbath years. But the principle in the law was, every 7th year, you don't reap. Questions or comments about the Sabbath year? Bill.
What was that you just read? 2 Chronicles what?
36:21. Wendell. Well, the manna fit this pattern of the seventh day Sabbath that we see in 12 and 13. Tim.
Were they supposed to store up like nets or just?
Yes, the Lord would allow them to have enough crops to tide them over, so to speak. I forget which passage says that, but that's said somewhere. Eric.
What's the idea that the poor could be made?
Well, the poor could then go into the fields and the vineyards and so forth and get it. And eat it. Whatever, just grew up volunteer.
You don't think that's the primary reason behind that, or?
I think the primary reason is just this seventh day, seventh year belongs to the Lord, the seventh rest concept. I don't know really. There's several other things like the boar eating it, yeah. but I think the idea is the seventh belongs to God. Yes.
The seventh year, was that the seventh year, was that like at the same time for all people? Or
I think so. I think it was. That's a debated issue, but I think it was. Daniel.
I've heard this, it's like printed in Isaiah 61 under the year of the Lord's favor, when it's predicting the time of Messiah, like it's referring to like this sabbatical year that like.
Probably was referring to the Jubilee year. Did you have in Leviticus 25, am I right? I think so.
What's the difference between that and that?
The Jubilee year was every 50th year, where like even long-term leases reverted back to their owners and things like that. Okay. Then you've got the Sabbath day. We've seen that already, 12. And it gives rest to your animals and to your servants as well. Then he says in verse 13, don't mention the name of other gods. Don't even talk about them. The more we talk about sinful things, the more familiar we get with them, the easier it is to slip into them. You know, he said, just don't even speak their names. That's not an absolute prohibition, obviously, because God sometimes in the law will speak the names of certain foreign gods. But don't talk about them in too familiar a way. And then you've got these annual feasts. In verse 15, what feast?
Unleavened bread.
Yeah, we've heard about that one already. That's the Passover, those 7 days following the Passover. Then in verse 16, he mentions two more. Which are they? The Feast of the Harvest and the Feast of the
In-Gathering.
Yeah, the harvest is where they gathered the first fruits. The in-gathering is where they had gathered the crop in general. Now, we call both of those more commonly by other names. Do you know what other names we give to the Feast of the Harvest? Pentecost in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, we call it the Feast of Weeks or... It's also, I believe this is in Numbers, it's called the Day of First Fruits. So it's the Feast of Harvest, the Feast of Weeks, the Day of First Fruits, or Pentecost. All those are referring to the same day, 50 days after Pentecost, essentially. Or after Passover, essentially. Sorry about that. Feast of the Ingathering, which one is that? Yeah, Tabernacles or Booths is what we call them. Okay? Comments or questions through verse 17 on these three annual feasts? John.
So in the Sabbath year, did they still observe these without the crops being brought in?
I hadn't thought about it. I assume so. Really, it never crossed my mind. And then in verse 18, the blood, you're not offered the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread. So the leaven couldn't be offered with the sacrifice. Nor is the fat of my feast to remain overnight till morning. The fat belongs to God and ought to be offered to him right away, not kept overnight. You bring the first fruits into the house of God. And this last one in verse 19, you're not to boil a young goat in the milk of its mother. What's that all about? It's
disgusting.
Do what?
It's disgusting.
Disgusting.
Can't mix meat and dairy.
That is what the Jews think even to this day. Kosher foods, in part, they're not allowed to use, you know, I think maybe even the same kitchen for dairy products and meat products. That's exactly what they do. They make a huge distinction in their diet. They don't eat meat and dairy products at the same time and so forth. So that's exactly what the Jews take that to mean. I doubt that is what it means. Well, what does it mean?
I heard something about that you're not supposed to do that to the young goat because I'm going to throw his mother and that she's
Yeah, I've heard things like that too. It sounds kind of funny when we say it that way. Exodus 34:26, end of it, says, "You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk." In Deuteronomy 14 and verse 21, the end of it, "You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk." So there's three times he tells us that in the law. Here's what I think. I don't know for sure. What I think is this was probably a part of a Canaanite ritual for the Canaanite gods. And he's telling them they can't observe this part of Canaanite worship. That's my guess. I wouldn't be dogmatic about it. But Roger.
Is there a reference to that in Chronicles somewhere?
Not that I know about it. Jonathan.
For laws like that, I think when they got them, were they like, okay,
like there was something they were in the practice of doing, there was a future.
Unless perhaps they already knew about it being practiced, or maybe they did, the Egyptians did too, I don't know. All right, any other questions or comments through 19? Okay, 20 to 33.
Behold, I sent an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I prepared. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will set my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you, until you have increased and possessed the land. And I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the wilderness to the Euphrates. For I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in the land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you.
So, I'm going to send an angel before you to take care of you, to bring you into the promised land. But you need to be obedient. You need to do what I say. And when you come into the land of all these other nationalities, what were they supposed to do? Completely destroy them. And what about their gods and their God's stuff? Totally destroy them, utterly overthrow, break their sacred pillars in pieces. You are supposed to demolish all the idol apparatus. Why? Yeah, there's only one God, but why not just sell it or let it go or whatever?
God causes you to sin, pluck it out. It's a radical amputation. Get completely rid of.
Yeah, I think Seth's right. You know, this is going to be a stumbling block to them. What do we do if somebody has cancer? You know, there's a cancerous, you know, something or other, growth on their face or whatever. Do you grab it and pull it off and let that be that? No, that might be a little extreme. But what are we worried about?
All of it.
Yeah, it might grow back. So what do we try to make sure we do?
Get it all.
Get all the cancer cells. You know, we're really worried about trying to get all of them out. This is the same idea. This is like a cancer. You know, these idol gods, they're gonna infiltrate, influence. And so you don't want to just, you know, smash up a few of them. You can just annihilate all the idolatrous apparatus. And then God will take care of you. God will bless you. You know, he said, I'll send the hornets ahead of you. They'll drive out the Canaanites. Not all at once, because you won't be able to take possession of the land all at once. It'll be a step at a time. I'll drive them out. I'll give you the land. And again, verse 32 and 33, don't make any covenant with them or with their gods. Don't serve their gods, it'll surely be a snare to you. So, just very strong instructions about what they're to do when God blesses them with the land. Comments and questions? Jacob.
I think this is helpful because I think we sometimes underestimate just how tempting it might be to us. And you can imagine an Israelite, like, that's not going to tempt me. I mean, whatever you say to yourself. And things often are so much more tempting and alluring to you in ways you never thought they would be. Not because you're anything special, it's because, I mean, sin is tempting. And so we think we're going to be fine with it. And when God tells us ahead of time, no, you need to get rid of every piece of it, that's going to be for our own good.
Good point. Michael.
The hornets that he sends, do you think that those were, it reminds me just of the words that they heard at Jericho. They knew this people was coming. Is it something along those lines that they heard the reputation of things?
I don't really know in what form these hornets came. I don't know if somebody has a good thought on that or not. I think he's just saying I'll be driving them out a step at a time. But I don't know if that there's some specific thing the hornets represent. I've got Jonathan and then Mason.
About the issue of painting the idols and trying to eradicate them. In Deuteronomy 7, they were told to not even want them, but to hate them. And even today, with the idols and sins of Israel, we need to learn to begin to associate and identify with God in His perspective and hate them with equal passion as He does.
Good point. Mason.
Verse 29, God's wisdom, not doing things the way we would expect it or would do it, how He's just slowly letting them in and slowly getting the Canaanites. But at the same time, in the context of stay away from these other gods, God's going to stick them in the middle of all of this, the middle of all their influence. And He's saying, God could have, again, He could have wiped them all out, and that influence being minimal. But God puts them in there, apparently, to test them, even
sure.
If they're still in.
Yes, it's going to be a challenge for them. But if they'll do what God says, everything will be great. You know, God will be with them and bless them. It'll be a good thing. Andrew?
I just want to make sure, is this God speaking to them right now or Moses?
Well, I think it's God through Moses.
Okay.
Yeah. Very good.
I'm not mistaken that the border never actually did end up going all the way to Euphrates.
It pretty much did in the days of David Solomon. Yeah, in fact, I don't know if I can find the passage that says that easily or not. I may find it before I do. How about 1 Kings 4:21? Now Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. And I think the river there is the Euphrates. So I think David had conquered all the way up to the Euphrates. Tim.
The providence he offers in 25:26, I mean, that's just very physical blessings to serve me than I would. And that's an isolated thing, yes. I mean,
well, I mean, there's a lot of promises of physical blessings in the law overall. You know, even the blessings and cursings of the covenant, like Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28.
So do you think, reading through that, I don't take it as just it's like, well, if you're good, then naturally, the world, good things will happen to you. I think God's promising to give them the supernatural, like His divine
I agree.
Promise. And so, I mean, it doesn't seem like, though, that kind of promise is made for us.
I think those promises are much more spiritual for us, that our promised land and our promised blessings are primarily being with the Lord. Yeah. Other thoughts? Yes, Jim.
Is this what happens? I guess we see this in Judges and Joshua, this idea of they don't drive them out 1 year, and so they kind of, little by little, do you see that played out in those books?
It could have been. And Joshua went in, and basically the strength of the resistance was broken. You know, Joshua was able to defeat various coalitions, you know, in the north and the south and so forth. So, and then in Judges, the tribes were sent to their areas to finish the job, to drive out the rest of them. For the most part, they didn't. That's Judges 1. Judah did pretty well, mostly. But as Judges 1 continues, it just gets worse and worse. You know, and finally, you know, they let the Canaanites dwell among them. And then it starts saying about some of the tribes, they dwelt among the Canaanites. The Canaanites were the default population. And then the Danites, they didn't do anything. They didn't take any of it. You know, the Amorites wouldn't let them. Well, the Amorites weren't in control. God was. So it means they didn't trust the Lord to drive them out. And so God had the strength and wanted to, but the people didn't trust him. Or in some cases, they made slaves out of them, whatever. A lot of times, I think they didn't want to drive them out. So it never really worked because the people didn't allow it to. Other comments or questions? Eric.
We may have heard of this, but what is the idea of where he will not pardon your transgressions for my name is in him, part of the angel?
Well, I think he's saying if you're rebellious, you'll have to pay for it. Right. Or you'll be punished.
Why will he not forgive those transgressions because his name is in him? His name is in him.
Well, I guess he's saying he would treat them like I would treat them. I mean, he'd be like God. He's not going to pardon rebellious people.
Okay.
That's what I would say. Other thoughts? Well, you have listened patiently. I think this is probably good for tonight. Very good.